My Family Recipe is a new podcast from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network, bringing you cherished heirloom recipes and the stories behind them. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast, the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome chef, restaurateur, and cookbook author, Yetum Ottolenghi. In this episode, we'll talk to Yetum about what exactly goes on in the Ottolenghi Test Kitchen, his latest cookbook, Shelf Love, and we'll hear Yetum's Julia moment. Stay with us, we'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. While Julia rose to singular stardom, she was at heart a collaborator. Mastering the art of French cooking wasn't her idea, brought to Julia by Simone Back and Louisette Bertal, her co-authors. However, it's fair to say without Julia, it probably would have not become a best-selling phenomenon. Although Julia authored many subsequent books on her own, there was always a team behind her. You don't make hundreds of hours of television shows or write elaborate cookbooks alone. You need recipe testers, tasters, a photographer, someone to shop and run errands. The list goes on. Bottom line, it takes a village. A village that is wonderfully captured in the upcoming HBO Max scripted series about the birth of Julia's first cooking show, The French Chef. Someone who, like Julia, is very much a collaborator and willing to share the limelight with his village is celebrated chef, restaurateur, and award-winning cookbook author, Yetum Ottolenghi. If you spent any time in London, Ottolenghi's unique-sounding name is now as familiar as hummus in the grocery store. Stateside, he's best known for his innovative cookbooks, which began as a means to share with home cooks the Middle Eastern-inspired food available at his London restaurants. Born and raised in Israel, Yetum emigrated to the UK more than 20 years ago after earning a master's degree in philosophy from Tel Aviv University. He's the chef and owner of London's four Ottolenghi delis and Nopi and Rovi restaurants. His acclaimed cookbooks, many co-authored with his cadre of collaborators, have sold more than 7 million copies worldwide. Ottolenghi Simple won a National Book Award in the UK, and the New York Times named it a Best Book of the Year in 2018. Yetum writes a weekly column for The Guardian and contributes to the New York Times as well. Known for being vegetable-forward and using ingredients like preserved lemons, pomegranate molasses, and black limes, the Ottolenghi effect means once, quote, exotic ingredients are now more commonplace. Like Julia, you do not accomplish great things without a great team or even a research hub. Julia's was her Cambridge kitchen, and we've had many who staffed it on this show, like Chef Sarah Moulton in episode 87 or Dory Greenspan in episode 30. Yetum is supported by a team of co-creators and co-authors at his Ottolenghi Test Kitchen in North London. This includes co-author Tara Wigley, who we met in episode 120 with Ottolenghi's business partner, Chef Sammy Tamimi. It also includes his most recent co-author, Test Kitchen head, Norm Arad. Yetum joins us today to take us behind the scenes at the Ottolenghi Test Kitchen and to talk about the first in a new book series from the Ottolenghi Test Kitchen, Shelf Love, Recipes to Unlock the Secrets of Your Pantry, Fridge, and Freezer, which he's written with Norm. Welcome to the podcast, Yetum.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you for this incredible introduction.
My pleasure. Thank you for your incredible food and how you've changed the whole landscape of what we eat at home and in restaurants.
Thank you.
And I mean that just very sincerely, and I feel very fortunate to have eaten many times at several of them. And I also said, I think I said this to Sammy and Tara, that for those who don't know, Nopi may have one of the most fabulous bathrooms or restrooms in all of London. It's spectacular.
That's right.
One of my favorite rooms. And the food is pretty good, too. So I think our focus today is not sort of on everything, but particularly on the test kitchen and how that's become a focal point for your new book. But I wanted to kind of understand how it came into being, because not every chef and restaurateur has a test kitchen per se. And I was curious, so at what point in your career and in your journey to where you are now, did you create one?
So this test kitchen has been operating for about 10 years now, and really presented a shift in the way I operate. So my early books, Plenty and Jerusalem, I've done the recipe testing from home. So I would, I would buy the ingredients and do the cooking, the write-ups, everything from home. And even when there was a collaboration, like Jerusalem was written with Sami Tamimi, who you mentioned, I would test at home. And I found that fine, but I also found it quite difficult, because I'm a very social person and I love to be in a group and I love to be surrounded by people. And I find it really useful for recipe testing to have this feedback around you. So, when you cooked something, you don't just, try it yourself and draw conclusions. You actually have a one or two or three people, the more the merrier, to really kind of feed back what they think, and it's really, it makes a huge difference to your ability to understand what's going on in a dish, how good it is, how much it does what it is supposed to be doing, if you do include other people in this conversation. And so this is how the test kitchen came to be. For the next book, after Jerusalem, came Plenty More, I've decided to start the test kitchen, and then I've added people over the years to test recipes, and those have become my collaborators on books, from Tara Wigley, who you mentioned, to Easter Belfridge, who collaborated me on my previous book, Flavor, Helen Goh, Scully, a bunch of people that have been in the test kitchen working as a team, and the whole system of testing recipes have become a group effort rather than a singular effort. And I think that the recipes really benefit from being in that place, because it's super inspirational. People chat, there's really great conversations, problems are solved, and this has become the way I feel comfortable to work.
And I've worked closely, and may not, something I mentioned on the show, but you may not know. So the food writer Anne Willen, who's British but worked a lot in America, is my mother-in-law. And so I've worked with her, and certainly people often say, how did you write so many books? Because it's hard to count, because she's written series too, but it's like in the realm of 50. And it's not because she did it alone. She had a very similar system. It wasn't as formally described, but she had a big house in France, and they used to have a rotation of four stagiaires. And that was how you did it. And a lot of these stagiaires have gone on to be quite prominent people particularly the American food world. But from that example, is part of this that you've really enjoyed the cookbook writing process, and it's a means to kind of carry that on and make it bigger?
I think what it is that... So in my case, there's also the restaurants. And so we've got the test kitchen, which produces recipes for publication, for books and magazines and newspapers. And then there's the restaurants that obviously feed the public. And what I've noticed in restaurants is that, and in my restaurants, I don't create the menu personally. There's a head chef, and he or she would make something, and I would taste it, and we will have a conversation, and those conversations would inform the menu. I think this this system works really, really well for the test kitchen as well. Plus, I think for cookbooks, it's really, really useful to have a different person heading the process every time, or at least every, you know, one changing once in a while, because you do get a very, very different perspective. So I mentioned Ista, who's collaborated with me on flavor, and she has, Ista is an incredibly gifted cook, and she's, but apart from being just generally gifted, she has a very different background to mine. So she has spent a lot of time in her childhood in Mexico and where her grandfather lived. She has spent time in Italy, where her family lived for a while, and her mother is Brazilian. So those three cultures have really informed the way she cooks and really feature heavily in the book. This is not could have come from me, because I haven't had those experiences. So I let, you know, Ista go with those experiences and really color the book in those particular colors. And hence, although it's an Otto Lenghi book with a lot of, you know, features that people would recognize, you know, contrasting colors, the, you know, these kind of mixed mashups of cultures, the very colorful dishes, etc. It also has Ista's flavors in abundance. And in this book, OTK Shelf Love, Noor Murad, who runs the test kitchen, really brings her culture. So she grew up in Bahrain, which is a country in the Gulf, and her dad is Bahraini and her mom is English. So she grew up in between those two cultures, and she brings tons of those perspectives into this particular book. So you mentioned black limes. There's an extensive use of black limes. That I've used black limes, you know, those are dried lemons or limes, which are very, very common around the Persian Gulf. But Noor really mastered the use of those because she's grown up with them, and she does an incredible job. There is a recipe in the book for feta that is crusted with sesame seed and then served in a black lime and lemon and honey glaze, and it's just so wonderful. It's salty and it's nutty and it's sweet and it's sharp, and the black lime really makes that particular dish. So this book really has tons of Noor in it and her heritage, and I think that's what makes it, that's one of the reasons why it's so special. So this really works for me, but it really works for the books, and it makes them unique.
And you mentioned the restaurants and how things end up on the menu in the restaurants. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, and maybe you can clarify, is there interplay between what happens in the test kitchen and the restaurants? Or the test kitchens are more focused on the publications and the restaurants are driven, restaurant menus and dishes are driven by the head chefs there?
So generally speaking, this separation does exist. So we are really focused on home cooks, and the restaurants are focused on restaurant dishes that are served at the restaurants. And there isn't much of an overlap. These are cooking for in a restaurant and cooking at home are two really very different activities. But also simply because there's other people doing the other things. There's also this just a very practical reason why these things are being done separately. But there is a lot of exchange happening between the test kitchen and the restaurant. So occasionally I would send the chef in one of the restaurants when they're thinking of the next seasonal menu. A bunch of recipes that have recently come out of the test kitchen and say, see what you can do with that. And more often than not, these are featured later on in the menus, but with a lot of changes. So, you know, you would have like, we did this fish curry a few years ago in the test kitchen, then that one particular element, the kind of that butter curry that we created has featured in a much more complex dish of a whole fish with flatbreads and the curry and grated coconut and a little salsa of herbs in the restaurant. So there are exchanges and they do happen, but the transformation from the test kitchen to the restaurant or from the restaurant to the test kitchen is quite dramatic. So you would not necessarily recognize a dish that started in one place when it features in the other.
So it's kind of like there's an interplay, but then also an independence.
That's right. That's right. And then, yeah, and I always emphasize to people who are interested in this, in my world, that, you know, if you arrive in the world of professional cooking, you have a certain set of expectations that are normally based on what it's like to cook at home, you know, for yourself, for your family, for a dinner party. And then restaurants operate so very differently. And as a result, restaurant dishes are so completely different than those served at home.
And it sounds like you embraced a topic that we've come back to many times that is a kind of evolving mantra, actually from chefs, restaurant chefs who are writing books, that the food they cook at home and the food that everyone should cook at home shouldn't be the same as restaurants. And having some aspiration to put out molecular gastronomy in your home kitchen is sort of, if you will, forgive the phrase or pun, a recipe for disaster. It sounds like you kind of advocate that separation too, because it's so hard to do restaurant food at home.
I think for certain people, those challenges are great. And especially now over the last couple of years during the pandemic, we have seen people really pushing the boundaries and trying really complex things at home. But generally speaking, I think home cooking does one thing and restaurant cooking does another. And I am personally, you know, and most people that I know, when I come home, I want to deal with a comforting, with a familiar, with the sustaining. And I think those are the dishes that have a home, they kind of nestle, you know, comfortably in a home kitchen and not so much in a restaurant. This is a gross generalization. Of course, many restaurants serve home food. Many homes are, very experimental if there's someone there who's pushing that agenda. But as a general point, I feel that people at home really enjoy cooking with a familiar, with things that have been made before, that have a name, that have a history. Within a household or the extended family, and those are the dishes that people really enjoy in the home setting.
We talked about the sort of interplay between the test kitchen and the restaurant and the independence, but I'm guessing one of the big linkages is you and your being the mastermind, if you will, behind the Ottolenghi universe. How frequently do you join the team in the test kitchen?
I really have to raise my hand and admit that it happens less and less with the years. The reason why is that I spend time on my own, you know, speaking to people like you. So I've become much more of a kind of an ambassador and a conductor than someone who actually spends real time in the kitchen. Having said that, I spend a lot of time in conversation, conceptualizing, having tasting food, commenting, etc. And I'm happy with that. I mean, I've also, you know, this is why I think really talented people are very happy to put their invest their talents in the test kitchen or in the restaurants, because they have a fee, they get from me a complete carte blanche to create and present recipes that are fully owned by them. Although, as I said, they always come out of conversation. So Noor, who is the head of the test kitchen and really is, I can't tell you enough how talented she is the one who's much more hands-on than myself. But I occasionally come in, I say, okay, let's try this. And I send ideas over and then we taste them. So I'm involved, but a bit more at an arm's length now.
Now, I was mentioning about Anne Willen and La Varenne, and Anne has a very specific recipe testing methodology. And maybe it's not the actual testing that's specific, it's the evaluation, and there's a specific form and you look at things. Does the Ottolenghi test kitchen have a similar, like everybody fills out a sheet or the evaluation, or is it more informal and by feel and conversation?
Yeah, the latter. So we don't fill in any form, but we express our views very clearly in conversation. And I live and breathe these conversations. I find them so inspiring. You know, when a group of us, two, three, four people, grab forks and taste from a bowl. And each one would say, oh, you know, I'm just missing that little bit of depth, umami depth. And let's kind of see what we could do about that. Maybe, a spoonful of soy sauce, or maybe we should make an anchovy butter at the beginning and spoon that on top, or et cetera. So, you know, that could be a wonderful thing that just is just added through a conversation. But we are very rigorous until we're really totally happy. The dish would never leave the test kitchen. And sometimes you could test something, you know, a dozen times if it's really challenging until you really get it right. And then there is another station once the dish is done and we're happy with it. There is another authority, which is it's a woman called Claudine, and she lives and she tests the recipes at home. She lives in Wales. She has a husband and three kids, and she tries the recipes on her family. And she sends us quite a detailed report about what was it like to test the dish at home, from how complicated it was for her to get the ingredients, who liked it, who maybe didn't respond so well to it, etc. So we make sure there's this one extra step in which the dish is evaluated somewhere, which is, I would say, it's called more neutral. And only once we've had Claudine's approval, then the new recipe finally leaves the test kitchen and finds its new home.
Well, that's a great transition to talking more specifically about the new cookbook, which we're going to do after this break. We'll be right back with more from Yotam Ottolenghi to talk about the Ottolenghi Test Kitchen's new cookbook. Stay with us.
Good food is worth a thousand words. This is Aarti Menon, and I'm delighted to share a new podcast with you, My Family Recipe, from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. Adapted from Food 52's much-loved column of the same name, the My Family Recipe podcast will bring its pages to life. Each episode of My Family Recipe brings you a cherished heirloom recipe and the story behind it from voices across the world of food.
We'd open these tubs of dough and they would exhaust these incredible yeasty fumes, and it just smelled like nothing else. It was so intoxicating.
I'll interview writers and chefs, parents and children, about what's passed down along with the foods that we know and love.
Chinese people aren't like born with a download on how to like velvet chicken. You know, like that's not something that just like comes to you.
Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. We're talking to acclaimed chef and best-selling cookbook author Yotam Ottolenghi about the first book in a new series from the Ottolenghi Test Kitchen, Shelf Love: Recipes to Unlock the Secrets of Your Pantry, Fridge, and Freezer, co-written with Noor Mourad, the head of the test kitchen. So, Yotam, what's the story behind, we've talked about the test kitchen, but what's the story behind the idea that there should be a book series specifically under this test kitchen umbrella?
So about 2 or 3 years ago, we started having these conversations in the test kitchen about creating a series of book which will tackle specific questions, you know. And so a bit more focused. So, you know, a traditional Ottolenghi cookbook, if you could say, use this word, is quite wide ranging. You know, it would have a whole load of things, and it wouldn't have a very, very particular angle. You know, it might be vegetables or it might be sweets, but it's a very kind of wide open-ended recipe book with lots of individual stories, etc. But it's quite broad. And we wanted to make a series of books that are slightly more focused on particular skills and solutions. And because we feel that in our test kitchen, we have a ton of experience and knowledge and recipes that are really, waiting to be shared with the rest of the world, but aren't maybe perfect for one of the big books. So we want to create these other books. And we couldn't quite hone in on something that on an angle. And then this was, so we started this conversation in 2019, and then all of a sudden we're in lockdown, you know, there is a pandemic, and we had to shut the test kitchen, and all of us had to go and cook at home for ourselves or our families, you know, where each one in a slightly different scenario. And all of a sudden, there it was. The solution was there in front of us. You know, we were all, you know, raiding our larders and our pantries, trying to find ingredients to substitute the pasta we couldn't get on the supermarket shelf. Or, you probably remember, the whole world remember how difficult it was to go out shopping.
The flour in London, flour, right, disappeared from the shelves for
flour and yeast, like you say, and so many other ingredients. So hence shelf love, you know, you've got your kitchen shelf, and let's try to explore what's on it and what's in it to create incredible meals and really feast like meals, not like something, you know, like when you think of dried chickpeas and lentils, and you know, a bag of frozen peas, you think frugal, you think very kind of basic, mundane, possibly. We wanted to bring out all the richness and all the glory and all the beauty that lies in those very humble ingredients, but also show that if you don't have to be very precise about it or prescriptive about it, you can actually substitute, you can use one thing for another. These are not sacred recipes. These are recipes that can be played with. So this is where this book came from, the idea that we are celebrating ingredients that are there anyway, or are easy to find, or are easy to substitute. So we create this kind of traditional notebook-like book. It's a substantial book, don't get me wrong, but and it's got 80 plus recipes that are, you know, glorious. But it embraces the pantry. It embraces versatility. You can take note. There's little boxes on every page where you own notes, like old school, like our, you know, grandparents used to have, where you take notes, you wrote what you've done, you write suggestions for next time. It really is about frugality, ingenuity, and celebration of simple, cheap, delicious ingredients.
Well, that's pretty fascinating that it is very much, at least in its in the form that has been published, a kind of pandemic reaction, at least in terms of what the first book in the series is. Has your team mapped out what the second and third is, or it's a little bit of a let's roll this out and then see what comes together?
We do have the second. We don't have the third, but the second book would be. So it's funny. So we thought, like, okay, we're emptying our shelves. We have emptied the larder. We used the last bag of polenta, the last jar of cannellini beans. You know, we've used up our freezers. Now what do we do? So the next recipe book, which will be published next year, is about filling up those spaces again with wonderful condiments. So the recipes in that book, in the book that's going to be published next year, we'll have each recipe will have a little takeaway. So if you are making a sauce, you'll use it for that recipe, but then you can double it and keep a jar in your fridge for the next time you cook, or marinate, or sprinkle, or a quick pickle. Those are elements in a dish that can be kind of carried through to the next time you go to the kitchen and want to cook something else. So it's about filling up your pantry again. And the funny thing is, like, I don't know about you, but I found myself during lockdown making a lot of those, you know, pickles and preserves and marinades and chili oils, things that are really, really useful if you just want to boil a pot of rice and that's what you're going to have for supper. So, you know, a little fermented onion with a chili sauce is almost enough to turn that into a very simple meal. So essentially, yeah, it's also a reaction to the world we live in, to the pandemic, but what came later after we've used up what's in the pantry.
Yeah, no, I think that's been a great learning for people. In fact, we had just had two fresh pomegranates, and usually you would never eat that much pomegranate at one sitting. And so I took all that time to take them apart, and I took like two tablespoons, and then I put the rest in the freezer. But that means, you know, that I think is a theme of this book, that I have them for salads or not a lengthy recipe when I just need two tablespoons of them.
Yes, or probably if that the next book will tell you that you should take this pomegranate and cook those down into a pomegranate jam or relish, and then you could use that next time you you cook pork, or if you fry tofu, or you know, those there's ways to use that pomegranate and cook it down into a condiment that is will come out very useful. And next time you want a quick meal.
Yes. No, and I think one of my favorite discoveries, which I think, I don't know if it directly comes from Ottolenghi, but comes from the Ottolenghi effect, is like using pomegranate molasses that you can buy in the shop as a kind of background note in salad dressings. It doesn't totally change the flavor. It just adds these, I feel like it adds these kind of like levels.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
So on that note, are there some other, you know, well, you've literally entitled the book Unlocking the Secrets of Your Pantry. And so I was going to ask you, which is quite interesting because it relates to, and I'm not even sure your team was conscious of this, like historic culinary books, before they were even called cookbooks, were often kind of partly medicinal and used the word secrets a lot about which really meant about sharing knowledge. And so what are some of the secrets or what other secrets that our pantries hold for us?
I'm glad you created this analogy, because I really do think that we are in this point in history really relearning to decipher or figure out secrets that are available through our pantries and when I use the word pantry, I don't mean literally the pantry, because there's other places in the kitchen where you can store food. It's the freezer or the fridge or the veg box. But those are, what I mean by that is the staples, you know, the things that are there. You reach out and get them, and you don't go on a journey to go and buy them. So, I mean, tons of things. You know, I can start off by talking about rice. So, you know, there is a... you know, we all know how we love to cook rice, and but during lockdown, I've cooked so much rice, and I had so much leftover rice. I've created tons of rice cakes the next day, where I combine the rice with a bit of yogurt and some egg if you want to, and tons of herbs or finely chopped veg. And just create this kind of quick fritters or latkes that you fry. Really, again, like rice, as you know it, is esloft, leftover, turning into something totally delicious the following day. You know, chickpeas. I think I can't tell you enough how much you can achieve with chickpeas, and you can use a jar or a tin, and like there's an incredible recipe this is the one I cook almost, you know, on a regular basis now, which is a recipe for a confit tandoori chickpeas. Calls for two tins of chickpeas, garlic, ginger, chilies, tomato paste, a bit of cumin, turmeric, and that is very slowly cooked in olive oil for, you know, a good hour and a half. And without doing anything, you've got a wonderful chickpea stew that then can then be served with bread, or rice, or barley, or whatever it is you wanna serve it with, and it's marvelous. And who would have thought that humble can be the absolute focus of something so wonderful? But you know, I guess every recipe in this book really tells that story. You know, we have a recipe for another fritter, which uses a bag of these frozen mixed vegetables. Like, I don't know about in America, but here you can get a bag of frozen mixed vegetables, like a cauliflower, carrot, and peas, you know, together. Mm-hmm. And for me, as a snobbish, you know, cook, it would be probably the last thing I would get when I go to the supermarket. Why would I? I would go and buy fresh broccoli. I'd go buy fresh carrots. But during the pandemic, that was available. You know, we needed to put meal on the table. So we created fritters with a dipping sauce that are based on these kind of mixed vegetable bags that I'm sure a lot of people that are not as foolish as I am would have in their freezers. So yeah, there's tons of those, and every one of them is a wonderful, tells a wonderful, you know, pantry or freezer or veg box secret.
And so you just mentioned, so I think you said it's confit of chickpeas. This is stew that you discover that you would keep.
Yeah, confit. We call it confit tandoori chickpeas. So essentially it's chickpeas that are slowly cooked in olive oil with a bunch of aromatics for like an hour and a quarter. And then, then they're served with yogurt or you don't have to serve them with yogurt, but they're nice with yogurt and rice, let's say, or flatbread.
And I think a lot of the recipes are maybe more streamlined and more everyday than in some of your books, you know, famously known for very long lists of ingredients.
That's right.
Are there some dishes too? I felt like there were a couple that at least the photography really looked like showstoppers. There were a couple that could you describe that you found came out of this pantry freezer exploration, but actually in the end, the test kitchen team kind of created a dish that you could use as a centerpiece for entertaining.
Yeah. So we did want those as well. So the dish that I love the most for this particular purpose is the celebration rice that we have. Mm-hmm. And that's a rice that is cooked with chicken stock. So, you know, you boil a chicken and use the stock to... It's a spice stock with garlic and cumin and cinnamon. It's like beautifully sweet and savory. You use that to cook your rice, and then that rice is laid out on a platter and served with the chicken shredded, some fried minced lamb with pine nuts, and then that's finished off with pomegranate seeds and coriander or cilantro and a yogurt sauce. So it's a kind of one of these beautiful platters in where the rice is like a carpet, and that's bejeweled with, as I said, chicken, nuts, lamb, pomegranate seeds. It's absolutely beautiful to look at, and it's such a marvelous thing to bring to the table if you're hosting a feast.
And the other thing that I think is exciting out of the test kitchen, which I was quite delighted to see, is a new digital series where you tell me what you guys are calling it. But can you tell us more about that?
Oh, yes. We started a series on YouTube, again, to tell the same story as the one we're trying to tell through the book, which is all about how our approach to ingredients and the way we cook and the solutions and the ideas that come out of the way we cook in the test kitchen. So it's called the OTK, Ottolenghi Test Kitchen, and we call it What's for Dinner. And each one has a dish and maybe a side dish that could be the center of a, I would say, modest supper. And it's full of tips, and, you know, it's a very leisurely conversation between two members of the test kitchen. Noor and I have been in it, but also other members of the test kitchen. And it's really kind of a fun way to tell a story of a dish through a video and a conversation. And it's been real fun. And again, it's the same old thing. Like we're trying so many recipes. We're constantly immersed in food, and we're sharing those through videos now, as well as written recipes.
And is there an aspiration for it, or do you see it as kind of companion content to go along and bring the books in the Ottolenghi Test Kitchen series to life?
I think for me, it's really important that it's a great way to feature all the members of the test kitchen, because they, as I said to you earlier, each one of them comes with a different story and a different angle and a different way of cooking, and featuring them tells the bigger story. So it's a kind of an independent thing. And I think we will carry on doing it alongside the books and the other publications. But you know, it's something that we would like to carry on doing going into the future.
Well, I love that connection, which feels very Julia, that you know, while food and talking about food and dissecting dishes and testing them is important, and taste and where food comes from is important, but ultimately it comes down to the people involved in that whole process, and without them, it's not particularly meaningful.
And their stories, you know, I think for me, recipes are great, but out of context, they feel a bit hollow. And so it's very, I love the taking the possibility, the opportunity to tell the story of a dish, you know, how it came about, what's actually happening when you cook it, or you know, it's just a more all-round, it gives a much better picture of what it is that we do and what it is that we eat. And I think, like, food, the context of food, you know, the stories that are happening around food are just so fun that I wouldn't miss an opportunity to tell that story.
Well, we're going to ask you to tell one last story with your Julia moment, which we'll come to after the break. Stay with us for Yotam's Julia moment. And get in touch. Send us an email or voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org. Or better yet, tweet us @JuliaChildJCF and let us know what you think about today's show. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's where I ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she might have inspired them in their career. All right, Yotam, what's your Julia moment?
So I actually have a very good answer to this question, because when I started cooking, you know, professionally quite late in my life, in my late 20s, and I spent... And before I committed to this world of professional cooking, I wanted to learn more. And I, at the time, and I'm talking about the mid-1990s, so quite a long time ago, I was living in Amsterdam in Holland, and I had quite a lot of free time because I finished my university studies, and I decided that I want to see what it's like to cook really traditional French food. I was, you know, I knew how to cook. I cooked, but I never cooked properly. You know, I never learned the names of the cuts of vegetables or how to make a proper stock. I did it in the kind of traditions of the Middle East, Israel, the Palestinian cooking, Israeli cooking, the things that I've seen as I was growing up, and my parents cooked at home. So I ordered the two or three volumes of The Art of French Cooking from a bookshop in London called Books for Cooks, and a shop in Notting Hill on just off Portobello Road. And I got it in the post in Amsterdam, and I embarked on my mastering of The Art of French Cooking through Julia's books. And it was very funny because I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I didn't really realize they were so detailed and so precise. And so I don't think I managed more than, you know, a few recipes, but I did learn how to make a few stocks, a few basic sauces. And then I thought, like, I just can't do it myself. As you've already figured there was a theme there. I don't like doing things on my own. So this was when I enlisted in the Cordon Bleu Cookery School in London and came to learn French cooking, you know, from teachers rather than myself in the room with a book. But I still have those books and I cherish them and I love them. And they feel very special because they were literally my first steps into the world of professional cooking.
Well, that's a lovely story. And I have to say, from my chair at the foundation, I never cease to be amazed. Every podcast we think, oh, well, there might not be a linkage between Julia and this guest. And there almost always is. And so that's just extraordinary to hear that those books, even if you didn't, you know, do a blog of cooking every single recipe, they did spur you on to where you've gotten to now.
Definitely. They really, really did.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Todd. It's been a real pleasure.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. It's at Ottolenghi UK on Facebook and at Ottolenghi on Twitter and Instagram for the latest. The cookbook is Ottolenghi Test Kitchen, Shelf Love, Recipes to Unlock, The Secrets of Your Pantry, Fridge, and Freezer by Norm Arad and Yota Ottolenghi, with photographs by Elena Heatherwick. It's out November 2nd from Clarkson Potter. Ask or search for it at your favorite bookseller. Make sure to follow the Foundation for news on how to watch the presentation of this year's Julia Child Award on November 4th. It's at Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T. Shulkin on Twitter. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks to my co-producer at the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our usual sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Matt Patterson. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.